love traffic mornings. There it is. Hopefully everyone had a nice break. I realized this morning I never posted you midterms. I get F. Little bit of advice for y'all. Don't work like four jobs. Just have one. I will get those done when I go home this afternoon. They're up and posted. Current. So pre-break, we were talking about the Senate. Actually, we were talking about Congress in general, but the Senate specifically. Because if you recall, in our Constitution, the framers, as part of the Connecticut Compromise, gave us a bicameral legislative body, which essentially means two chambers. And of course, we also, someone touched upon it correctly, the reason why we have two chambers. It's all part of the idea, not only that involves separation of power, but it's one of the important mechanisms to keep our government in check, which of course we refer to as checks and balances. The founding fathers understood that by having two chambers in the legislative body, if one makes a bad bill, the other one cannot allow it to pass, can vote it down. Essentially, one chamber has the ability to veto the other, although it's not formally veto. Why? Well, this will force compromise. This will force the two chambers to work together for the common goal of passing a good bill. Now, keep in mind, we also discussed when we talked about the Constitution, back for exam one, we also talked about the fact that the intent of the two chambers were different. The House was supposed to be the body that was representative of the people, which is the reason why it's called the House of Representatives. But the original intent of the Senate was to be more like the House of Lords, the Parliament, except that it was supposed to represent the states. So the people elected their reps, but the state governments chose their senators. So obviously, the interest of the state is different than the interests of the people. So to make sure they're all on the same page, you force this mechanism where to pass legislation, it has to be approved by both. Any questions on that quick recap? All right. Then we started talking about the specific powers of the Senate. I know there was a couple of people that are here now that weren't there on Wednesday. So what are the specific powers that the Senate has that is not held in common with the House? Anybody? None powers? Okay, fine, I'll go through them again. Treaties. The Senate ratifies treaties. President proposes it, but the Senate ratifies. 2/3 vote. The Senate approves presidential appointments, including members of the Supreme Court. the Senate holds the impeachment trials. It's the House that impeaches. And of course, as we're going to see when we get to the House, to impeach means to accuse. But it's the Senate where the trial is headed. And it's the Senate that renders judgment. Of course, to find guilty, or the individual accused guilty, the Senate must vote by a two-thirds vote. So there have been four impeachment trials in our nation's history for presidents. There have been some for judges and others, including Secretary of Defense. Although actually back then it was Secretary of War. In terms of the four presidents, none of them, or the four presidential impeachment trials, none of them were found guilty. They were all essentially acquitted. And last but not least, it's the Senate that selects the vice president if there is no majority in the Electoral College. Those are the four things that only the Senate can do. All right, trying to think of other things that we covered. We talked about the fact that every single state, big or small, has two. We talked about the nature of the fact that it represents the states. We talked about in design and structure. The fact that it's smaller allows it to be more informal. Technically, all senators are kind of like equals. Unanimous consent agreements. These are situations where, in order to avoid nitpicking, going after one another, the party leadership basically agrees in advance that both sides can submit to the record what other data they want. Again, this is proof that they are more gentlemanly, so then they don't have to vote over these little things. We also have the ability to suspend, put on hold any action of the Senate. All it takes is one senator to request that. And the last thing we covered was a quorum. In order for the Senate to conduct its most important business, to vote, there must be a majority present. And a majority of the Senate is 51 senators. Any questions on any of that? Of course, it's all in the book. All right. Well, the most famous, most talked about feature of the Senate is the filibuster. The filibuster involves a series of rules that allow unlimited debate. Essentially, because all senators are equal and they're not confined to time limits, a senator can literally take the floor and talk and talk and talk and talk. And it could be about anything they want. Now, the reason why they do this is to essentially talk a bill to death. Because even though it's informal, the Senate still has stuff on the calendar. The Senate still must get things done. And if one senator absorbs all of the time that's allowed for discussion and debate, he or she can essentially stop it from going to the floor for being voted on. Which means if it's not done by the deadline, it's dead. It's killed. Now, this is a powerful tool for protecting the minority party. When you have a majority party, if you're going to go on pure majoritarianism, whoever has the most will get anything they want. But the filibuster allows a member of the minority party to basically kill bills that the majority wants. It is the ultimate check and balance. FYI, the most glorious example of the use of a filibuster was done back in 1957. The Republicans had proposed the initial draft of what would become the Civil Rights Act when Eisenhower was president. But a Democrat from South Carolina by the name of Strom Thurmond would take to the Senate floor and he would talk continuously for 24 hours, 18 minutes.
Record?
Why did Strom Thurmond do this? Very simple. Strom Thurmond was a Dixiecrat. And despite what you may have learned in revisionist history, it was the Democrats who created segregation. And it was the Democrats who did not want to allow segregation to end. So this Democrat was determined to crush the Civil Rights Bill, which was drafted by the Republicans in the vein of the radical Republicans back during Reconstruction. Let's give them all equal rights, because after all, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who's in favor of this bill, was the commander-in-chief of the American and Allied forces in Europe. And he saw what happens when you put white guys next to black guys, next to brown guys, next to whatever color you want to use in the trenches. An amazing thing occurs. They all look out for one another. They all work together. Doesn't matter what you look like on the outside. If you're fighting shoulder by shoulder, the guy to your left and the guy to the right are going to become your buddies, and they're going to do everything in their power to make sure you come home. Why? Because they want you doing the same for them. But Strom Thurmond wanted nothing to do with it. So the Civil Rights Bill would essentially die, but it would be reimagined when Lyndon Baines Johnson was president in 1965. All right, another example. When President Barack Obama was president, the Republicans would use the filibuster to block Obama's nominees. Under the original Senate rules, you used to need a supermajority to appoint federal judges, including members of the Supreme Court. But the Democrat leader at the time, Democrat Harry Reid from Nevada, he unleashed what was known then as the nuclear option. Essentially, they changed the rules to allow judges, except for the Supreme Court justices, to get through on a simple majority vote. Thus, making it easier to get Obama's nominations through. Now, when the Republicans took control of the Senate in 2017, in retaliation, tit for tat, the Republicans then changed the rules again and lowered the standard to a majority vote for Supreme Court justices. But even with that, when Trump was in his first term, the Democrats used the filibuster 327 times in 4 years, which was a record, compared to only 24 during Biden's term on the Republican side. Now, where did this come from? Well, ironically, it dates back to the earliest days of the Congress. The very first Congress in the Senate, they created a procedural rule to end debate, which would allow a senator to essentially move the question. If any of you are familiar with Robert's Rules, that's basically a way of shutting down debate. All it takes is one person to get up and say, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the question. And then it forces the body to vote on whether we're going to continue talking or we're going to stop talking and just vote. Well, in 1806, the Senate got rid of the rule because they never used it, because there never was a need. But by getting the move the question, that's what procedurally created the loophole. Because now there was no way one person could stop debate. So fast forward to 1837, and there were a group of Whigs in the Senate that prevented Democrats from voting to remove a censure resolution against Andrew Jackson. Jackson left the presidency, and the Whigs passed a censure movement condemning his behavior. Because, you know, just side note, Andrew Jackson was the president that laid the legislative foundation for what would become the Trail of Tears. Well, he was condemned in the Senate, and his party, the Democrats, wanted to get rid of that to protect the legacy of Andrew Jackson, and the Whigs basically blocked it. No, we're going to keep this officially on record. Well, today, the rule remains in place. Fast forward to the World War I period, though, and there was a need to rush legislation through to support the war effort. So, during World War I, there we go, the Senate would draft the mechanism, the procedure to formally end a filibuster. And it's known as cloture. This mechanism was created by 12 anti-war progressives. They wanted to essentially filibuster a bill aimed at arming merchant ships to counter the German U-boats. Well, what this does, this procedural rule, is it is a vote to limit debate. Now, the way it works today is it takes 16 out of 100, 16 out of 100 senators to move for cloture. So, they all put their names on a piece of paper. The piece of paper is presented to the clerk of the Senate for it to be recorded. No action is taken on the day that the cloture motion is presented, but on day two, a quorum call is taken. Now, it's done by unanimous consent. They don't actually do a head count. A quorum is assumed or presumed. When that occurs, the presiding officer calls for a roll call vote. They're voting on whether to recognize the cloture motion. It takes 3/5. 60 senators to vote for cloture, which will then limit debate to 30 hours. I know it's really wonky. Take a step back. 16 members present a motion to cloture. Nothing is done on the day of presentation, but on the next day, the presiding officer calls for a vote. If 60 senators vote for cloture, by the way, debate is limited to no more than 30 hours. But, no individual member is allowed to speak for more than an hour. And no delaying motions are allowed. So you cannot request a hold. The clock is running.
And at the end of the 30 hours, a final vote must be taken on the measure. Yay or nay. Now here's the funny thing. Sometimes the Cloture vote is bipartisan. Because they want to shut this up. They want to get it done. But sometimes you cannot get the 60 vote threshold. Which basically means the party holding the floor, that individual, continue to go until they're out of time. But more often than not, the majority of the senators just want to shut the person up and just get to the floor and let's get this thing done. Because, guess what's up tomorrow? Another bill.
There's a lot of documentation on the internet that explains it. If you didn't quite get all the technical aspects that I just went through. Any questions on any of that?
Again, the unfortunate thing about procedural rules, there's no way to make it easier. That's as easy as I can get it. Let's give you all the steps.
All right. Now, in the Senate, there are leaders. And there is, specifically, two leaders that are constitutionally mandated. Oh, I haven't updated it.
The first is the person who holds the title, the President of the Senate, which is the Vice President of these United States. Of course, the Vice President is no longer Kamala Harris, but rather it is J.D. Vance. And we'll have to update this.
But this is a good example. Because this is something that Kami did a lot during the initial days of the Biden administration.
No, it's not. She wore the masks to do the virtue signal. No, it's not that. No, it's the primary job of the vice president is to be the tie-breaking vote. Because when Biden became president, there were 50 Democrats and there were 50 Republicans. So, the only way to prevent a tie is you have to have an odd number. So when the Founding Fathers made Article 1, they stuck in Article 1, Section 3, Clause 4,
that the Vice President of the United States, as the President of the Senate, who is supposed to procedurally, or she is supposed to procedurally, preside over the activity of the body, can only vote in the instance of a tie. Now, here's the irony. Back when Washington was president, and his vice president was John Adams, for the first several months of the very first Congress, John Adams went to the Senate and attended every single session. And he sat there calling people to recognize, you know, doing the job of a presiding member. But John Adams, wicked smart, constitutional scholar, brilliant legal mind, had the personality of a cantankerous old man. So he really irked the members of the Senate, and they voted to kick him out. They didn't want him sitting there. Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Go home. Because of that precedent, the vice president only became a heartbeat, but would be called in case of emergency.
So this vote, if I remember correctly, this was all of the COVID funding that went out. That, what the hell do they call it? Yeah, no, yeah, there was a name. I forgot the innocuous name of the bill. It went out, all the states got it, and the states allocated money down to the municipalities. And under the original rules, you were only supposed to use it for
improving water, sewerage, and communications. But it was called like the COVID relief bill, which of course those measures had nothing to do with COVID, but it was just a way of basically wealth redistribution. All right. Well, if there is no vice president that's presiding, who then is supposed to run the chamber? Well, Article 1, Section 3, Clause 5 establishes that when the vice president, or technically the president of the Senate, is not president, then the presiding officer would be the president pro tempore. The president pro tempore is typically an honorary position given to the elder statesman or woman in the majority party. So the last time I taught this class was during COVID. So at the time, the Democrats technically had the majority. So they selected, this is Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont. Although today it is Chuck Grassley, Republic of Iowa. Not that you need to remember the names for the test. So what does the president pro tempore do? Well, he or she doesn't really have specific powers other than controlling the gavel during open sessions of the Senate. They're to sit up on the dais and they're supposed to recognize all the speakers when they come to speak before the floor. They're the ones who are supposed to make sure that all of the bills are filed correctly during the hearing. They're the ones who allow through in unanimous consent, you know, evidence to support the vote, you know, be all of the formal stuff. But the president pro tempore cannot punish members, cannot censure members, cannot kick out members. All they do is control the gavel. Who wields the power? Well, the majority and the minority leaders, the leaders of the parties. Mitch McConnell has stepped down as Senate Majority Leader, the current Senate Majority, actually at the time he was the Minority Leader in this picture, but the current President Majority Leader is John Thune, Republican of South Dakota. At the time, Chuck here, good Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, was the Majority Leader, but now he's the Minority Leader. Who determines these leaders? The party. At the very first day of the first session of the new Congress, the parties separate and go into their own caucuses, and they basically pick their leadership. And to become the leader, you just have to get a majority of your party votes. Now, under Senate rules, you can't cross the aisle. A Democrat cannot go and vote for the Republican majority leader or vice versa. It's based on party identification. The only ones who can choose are those who go into the Senate as independents. So think Bernie Sanders. He's a socialist, but he's not a Democrat. He's a registered independent. So he can basically decide which party he wants to vote for. And since he was first elected, he has caucused with the Democrats. You're welcome. That was a good point. All right. Now, how effective are these guys? Well, it depends. This is pure personality. Pure personality. If you have the ability to get bills through, your party is going to be more likely to support you. That's the reason why Chuck Schumer has been Democrat leader, either majority or minority, since Harry Reid stepped down. And prior to Harry Reid was majority leader or minority leader in the Senate going back to the 90s. You know, the leaders who get to these positions, they tend to hold them for a long time just because they manage to get things done. But of course, if you're paying attention to the news, He has gotten himself into a little bit of trouble. We talked about that before break because he supported the continuing resolution that was put forward by the Republicans because he actually did the nonpartisan thing or the bipartisan thing, recognizing that you got to fund the government. Because if you don't fund the government, who gets hurt? Not only all the government employees, but all the people that get government benefits. So, you know, I don't like the continuing resolutions personally. I wish they would actually follow the budgetary process. But if this is what they got to do to keep the money flowing, then that's what they got to do. But I give kudos to anybody who's willing to step across the line for the betterment of the whole. But of course, the progressives and the Democrat Party are out eating them alive. Although I think it's settled down since last we were together. All right. Well, obviously, you have a 100-member body. You can't have just two leaders. There are other members and officers who assist the majority and the minority leaders. We're not going to necessarily crush you with them all, but I'll give you the major ones. Second in authority to the majority of minority leaders are the party whips. These are the members that go around and essentially whip up all the members of the party to make sure that everybody is on the same page. They go out and they do all of the backdoor deals to make sure that the party does not fracture. They also act as floor leaders if the majority of the minority leaders are not present. So, say there's committee hearings and the minority leader is on that committee, so he's not on the actual Senate floor because he's presiding in the meetings or involved in the committee meetings. The whip would basically go and make sure, you know, that the speakers who are organized and laid out on the schedule are getting to the mic and speaking and saying their things. There are also the party conferences. The parties, as I said before, do meet independent of the Senate. The technical name for the Democrats is the Democratic Caucus. Whereas the technical name for the Republicans is the Republican Conference. Now, why is this? Well, unfortunately, between the House and the Senate has definitely become more partisan in recent years than the House. So because of this, parties really have to keep a tight control over their independent members. Because every now and then, one of their members will go rogue. So one of the most famous examples in recent history, you probably don't remember it, but when Trump was president the first time, they actually passed a law that was going to kill Obamacare. Completely. And it passed the House, gets into the Senate, and John McCain, Republican, voted against the bill, joined with the Democrats, giving them a majority, essentially killing the bill. Why was that? Well, McCain had little interest in supporting the turtle, Mitch McConnell, because he hated Trump. So it became personal. But in the Senate, you can get away with that. Because as I told you, senators are very influential as individuals. And I think the last of the major partisan leadership items. I mean, again, I could get into the assistant leaders and the assistant leaders, but because all of that stuff's listed on the Senate website, but I don't really care about, you know, hurting your brain. But each party also has their own policy committees. So what do these policy committees do?
Well, these committees are the entities within the Senate that communicate out to the states. So, if the Senate Democrats are plotting a bill or a maneuver, it is the policy committee that will communicate to the Democrat leaders, not only at the Democrat National Committee, but they will also transmit the information to the Democrat leaders in all of the different states to kind of make the parties united.
The Republicans have the same. They have both a policy committee and they have a steering committee.
Why? Well, if you're going to play the game of partisanship, the only way to make sure that all of the Republicans in the country or all of the Democrats in the country are all for the same things is you have to communicate.
And of course, ironically,
while this is a useful tool, this is also the reason why so many people in our country hate party politics.
Because why should all of the Democrats be for all of the same things?
You know, shouldn't they be for what's good for their constituents? You know, you want all the Republicans being identical? No. You got to let these individual people listen to the people who put them in office, and that's what they should be for. But of course, we don't get that. But that's the nature of the beast.
Questions? Yes?
Would you consider it to be like a cult, then?
Maybe not a cult. Maybe not a cult. I don't know if there's any, like, people drinking the red Kool-Aid, so to speak.
Right.
But cult-like.
Cult-like, yeah, sounds like
it. It's more like team sports. I mean, if you're voting for the Red Sox, and you pay all the money to go to a Red Sox game, and you want your Red Sox players to play the best they can to get back to the World Series,
what would you do if you went and saw a Red Sox game and half of the guys in the Red Sox were out there wearing Yankee hats?
I'd be messed up in the head seeing that.
Exactly, exactly. So in that sense, you got to make sure the Democrats are kind of all on the same page. Because what do the Democrats stand for? Well, this is what we stand for. What do the Republicans stand for? Well, here we go.
It's just unfortunate. Because the nature of party politics does definitely do a blow against individualism and individual thoughts.
And how many people are in one party, the party politics? Like on the Democratic side, how many people make up that party?
What do you mean?
Like
nationally?
In the states.
Oh, in Massachusetts, and I only can tell you Massachusetts, about 22-23% of registered voters in Massachusetts are Democrats. Something like 12% are registered as Republicans, and the rest are unenrolled.
Wow.
So, yeah. But if you look out across the state, so, as a nation, it's probably, I think currently there are more registered Republicans than Democrats for like the first time in a long time. But it's not like one side has 70% of the voters. You know, it might be a situation of where, like, and you can look these numbers up online. I'm just speaking off the top of my head.
Sure.
You know, it might be a situation of, like, 36% are Republicans and 34% are Democrats.
Isn't our state, like, turned blue every year?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, 95% of our state government is controlled by Democrats. It hasn't been Republican since the 90s, or at least balanced since the 1950s. We used to be a Republican state, but it switched during the late 50s, early 60s.
And voting trends, though, if you looked at the last presidential election, there are huge red blobs that are appearing in Massachusetts. Worcester County, down in and around Fall River, Bristol County, down on Barnstable County, but were they voting Republican or were they voting Trump? You know, that's a huge factor. Republicans could be in a heap of trouble because Trump only has 3.5 more years. So what happens next time around? I don't know. It's
It's going to be fun to watch, though.
Midterms will be interesting.
Yeah, midterms will be huge. Yes?
It might sound like a stupid question, but because the Army granted it 4 years, he can't go for another 4 year term after this, right? He can only do 8 period total. Or could he go for another 4 years and make it 16 or 12?
It depends on who you ask. I am a kind of a constitutional purist, if you haven't been able to tell yet. And I am in the camp that basically people who serve the presidency are locked into 8 years. But there are some constitutional scholars out there that are arguing, basically saying that the Constitution doesn't specifically say that. Therefore, it would be 8 back-to-back years, continuous years, which potentially could open up a third term. I know why that was put in. That was to stop what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did, running for 4 terms. So I don't think the people who crafted the amendment and the language in there intended it to be, well, you could go for 4 years, then you could take 4 years off, then you could do 4 years, then you could take 4 years off. I don't think that's what they wanted. I think they wanted to go back to the model of Washington. 2 terms, over.
Reagan wasn't a fan of that. Which is one thing that's always thrown me for a loop.
What?
Reagan was not a fan of term limits for presidential presidents.
Yeah, don't forget, he was a FDR Democrat before the Democrat Party went really, really hardcore left. Just like Trump, which is ironic.
Well, what they're doing is I think they're reading into it. You know, that's the thing that lawyers have a tendency to do. You know, they don't go with the plain language. They go with, oh, how can we stretch it? How can we interpret it? And you know, the rules are the rules. If in the NFL the rules say that when you put the ball into the end zone, either by running it in or with a catch, you get 6 points, that doesn't mean, well, it doesn't necessarily mean you couldn't get 8 just because it says 6. I don't like playing that game.
Okay. Good analogy, I get it now.
I do my best, my friend. I do my best. All right, other questions? Complete side note, but we'll do the presidency, and I'm sure we'll come back to it. All right. House of Representatives, let's go to the other side of the Congressional Building. Now, again, as the Senate was designed to be the upper chamber, the elder chamber, the body that represents the states, the House of Representatives was designed for a different purpose. It was designed to be the representatives of the people. So as such, it was supposed to be the more passionate, not compassionate, but passionate, in that this was supposed to be the chamber where things got heated. Things, you know, there was excitement, there was arguments. You know, it's not supposed to be a big gentleman's club where we're all kind of like equals. No. The House of Representatives was meant to be where representatives of the people go and fight for the interests of the people. It was also designed to allow for more turnover. If the Founding Fathers was to come back and see people like Nancy Pelosi, who has been in the House of Representatives, I think, since the early 80s, they would be absolutely disgusted. They gave them 2-year terms for a reason. The expectation was it was supposed to be akin to military service. You would go in, you'd do a tour, serve your constituents, and then go back home. Not life careers. But don't forget, the Founding Fathers also did not like the idea of politicians either. They didn't like parties. Now, the design of the House of Representatives can be found in Article 1, Section 2. Again, the design for the Senate's Article 1, Section 3. In Article 1, Section 2, we are told that members are chosen every 2 years. So what does this mean? Well, every 2 years, whether it's a presidential election year or a midterm, the entire House of Representatives gets reelected, all currently 435 members. Members are elected based on districts. So a state is carved up into voting districts based on population data. Where do they get said population data? Not the consensus, but the census. Yeah, the census. Every 10 years, letters go home to all the houses in the country, and you basically identify who lives in the house. They collect that data, and they determine how many people live in a town, a county, a region. And then what the states are supposed to do, they're supposed to take the total population data and make roughly equally sized districts based on population. So, for example, if you look at the district map of Massachusetts, pretty much everything west geographically of maybe Amherst, that's all one district, the whole western third of the state. Why is that district so big? Well, there's not a lot of people out there, not high population density.
When they take the censuses to like determine who's going to run for like the House?
Right? No, the census data doesn't determine who's going to run. The census data determines how big the district is that the person has to run in.
Okay,
that clears that up. Sorry. Thank you. No worries. Anything else along that line? You got a question? Bring it, brother.
I'm still a little unclear as to like all the details, but do the districts get what's it called? Do they get like manipulated or like I guess gerrymandered the same way like presidentially? Okay.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
100%. That's where the phrase gerrymandering came from. Elbridge Gerry, one of the governors of the Commonwealth at the beginning of our country's history, made a weird district in order to get the Federalists an extra vote by stitching together towns as far north as Lowell and somehow bringing it all the way down to like Fall River. And the layout of the district basically looked like a salamander. And the goal was, if this town has X amount of Federalist voters, let's put them with the next town and the next town and the next town, and that's going to guarantee we get a Federalist seat. So in the modern sense, yes, our state is controlled by Democrats. They intentionally design the districts to bury Republican strongholds in districts that are outnumbered by Democrats to make sure that all nine of our representatives are Democrats. And by the way, perfectly legal. Perfectly legal. And why do I say that? Well, if you're paying attention to the news, guess what they've done down in Tennessee? Guess what they've done in places that the Republicans now have control? It's just the game that both sides play. Oh, one other side thought. It looks like, based on the census data, California is going to be losing seats again. New York is going to be losing seats. The Democrat states are losing because people don't want to live in Democrat states, and they're actually moving out. Texas might be getting as many as 4 more seats. So what do you think the Republicans in the Texas House are going to do? Because there are a couple of Democrat representatives. Well, let's take his district and surround it and all the Republicans, make that red. Just the games they play. And to go back to what I said earlier, that's one of the reasons why so many people get disgusted with party politics. Because it just doesn't seem clean. But those are the rules. All right. So, Schnakies, I forgot the qualifications. This goes under the design. In order to be a representative, at the time you take the oath of office, you must be 25 years old. 25 years old. Like in the Senate, you must live in the state that you represent. Actually, you have to live in the district.
25 years old, live in the district that you represent, and you must be a U.S. citizen for 7 years.
U.S. citizen for 7 years. So that's how we ended up with, what's her name? She was from Somalia. She's part of the squad.
Ilhan Omar.
Yeah. She was not born here. She came from Somalia. She moved into Michigan, but she was a citizen for 7 years, and that's basically allowed her to run, and she's in Congress now.
They've got a Somali stronghold up there.
They really, well, when Obama was president, he basically took a huge chunk of them and stuck them up there. All right. Specific powers. The House has two powers that the Senate does not.
The first power, all revenue bills, anything dealing with taxing or spending, all revenue bills must start in the House.
Why?
Well, one of the charges of the Sons of Liberty, that terrorist group, during the War for Independence, was no taxation without representation. So going back to that, the framers essentially felt that if the House members are to be the representatives of the people, then therefore only the House should start anything dealing with money.
Two. It is the House that impeaches. It is the House that impeaches. Oh, you know, I left one off. Just thought of another one.
It is the House that impeaches. And of course, to impeach means to accuse. Just because someone gets impeached, that doesn't mean they're going to jail. They are just accused of doing wrong.
And of course, high crimes, misdemeanors, those are the basis for treason, which can be found in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, which we'll talk about when we get to the presidency.
But any executive official that is nominated and approved with advice and consent of the Senate can be impeached. So cabinet secretaries, heads of federal agencies, they can be impeached. Presidents, vice presidents, and also every single member of the federal judiciary.
Ironically, in terms of numbers, and we'll talk about it when I talk about the presidency, or maybe it's the judicial branch. I do have it in there. I just don't remember where it is.
But the largest group of officials who have been impeached are actually federal judges.
If the president and, like, let's say the vice president both got impeached and were able to be, like, presidents anymore, would the person who would run it, like the second runner-up for president, become the
president? Speaker of the House. Speaker of the House. But the problem with that is that you can't do both at the same time. You would have to do one, get it done, and then do the second. But in the age of partisanship, and we saw it with Trump, and we saw it with Clinton, the majority members of the party of the president who is impeached will often not vote for their removal.
Of course.
For partisanship reasons.
Because the way impeachment has became, it is a tool of partisanship. Bill Clinton, did he lie under oath? Yeah, but he lied under oath of getting it underneath the desk in the Oval Office. From Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah.
Is that impeachable? Ugh. I don't think so. And look at what Trump was impeached for. He was impeached because he was communicating with Zelensky. And why was he communicating for President Zelensky of Ukraine? Well, he was trying to get proof that when Biden was vice president, he was using the office of the vice president to obtain personal wealth. The call was recorded. But do you think there's anything in that phone call was any different than any other time a president has called another leader of another country?
No. So that's why I wonder, why is that grounds for impeachment?
That's partisanship. The Democrats had the majority in the House. We're going to impeach them.
And then what was the second impeachment? Well, that should have never taken place because by the time they got that done, he was done. I didn't understand, constitutionally speaking, how could you impeach someone who's not in office anymore? But that was over what occurred on that protest that occurred on January 6th.
That's like locking the barn door after all the horses already escaped.
100%. 100%. So, in modern standards, I mean, when we get to the presidency, we'll talk about Andrew Johnson's impeachment. That was a little different. But as far as the last two presidents have been impeached, nothing but party politics. And that's not really what it was there for, but... That's how it's been used.
Was Clinton impeached for lying?
Yes.
Because either way, it's conduct unbecoming the office.
It is, but is that a high crime or a misdemeanor?
Right.
You know, when you look at what the Founding Fathers meant, when they referred to high crimes, a misdemeanor, they're talking about bribery. They're talking about assassination plots. You know, they're talking about really significant charges. Murder. It's basically... defining what is when you're under oath, does that reach that level? Yeah. I mean, there were people at the time arguing either way. At the time, I just thought it was a waste of time. But it was what it was. And the worst part about that, last thing and then I gotta go on, is that when the Republicans did that, that disrupted the only time in my life when the Democrats and the Republicans were actually working together to balance the budget. You know, had they not impeached Clinton for that, you probably would have got a balanced budget amendment, and we would not be $36 trillion in debt. All right, last specific power.
In the event that there is no majority in the Electoral College, it is the House of Representatives that chooses who is becoming the President of these United States.
So the Senate picks the Vice President, the House picks the President. And again, we'll get into the specifics when we get to the presidency. Questions? All right. Now, as your book does talk about, in terms of operations, the business in the House is more orderly. It's more formal. The reason being is that there are 435 voting members of Congress, plus an additional 6 non-voting members of Congress. D.C. gets one, and the 5 territories get one. So Puerto Rico has one, America Samoa has one, American Bahamas. I don't even remember where the other ones are, but wherever the territories are. So they can go in, but they just can't vote. So they can be part of the caucuses, they can be involved in committee hearings, but ultimately they're not allowed to make decisions on legislation. But the 435 can. But think about that. You got 435 voting members in a body. You have 365 days in the calendar. How are you going to get all of them to have equal time? You can't, other than reining things in. And that's what occurs. The House operation is tightly controlled through very strict rules of operation. Everything is based on procedure, including how long members can speak. Typically what they do is if the leadership decides to give 5 hours for the members to debate a bill, you take those 5 hours, you divide it by 435, and that's how much time each individual member has to speak on it. No filibuster. Filibusters are not allowed under the House rules. Why? Well, it only takes a majority vote to cut off debate. In the Senate, you have to do that cloture procedure. That takes multiple days. In the House, all it takes is a majority vote. The presiding officer is entrusted with the presiding officer has to make sure all the rules are followed. The guy or gal, whoever's up, presiding officer in the session, up at the DS with the gavel, there to make sure that all the rules are enforced. And if any member deviates from the rules, they can be removed by the sergeant at arms.
Had that ever happened before until the...
Yes.
The
not during a presidential joint session or State of the Union address, but it has happened during debate. If in a case of an emergency, the House, however, does have the ability to suspend its rules, but it takes a two-thirds vote. And if the House wants to basically eliminate all formal procedures and engage in instant action, they can do it with unanimous consent. So, 9/11 occurs. Terrorists from Al-Qaeda fly planes into the World Trade Centers, the Pentagon, another plane crashes in the field, don't have any idea what's going on, the nation is in a complete state of panic, and all air traffic control in the sky is ordered to the ground. We don't know if we are invaded, we have no idea what's going on. The House voted, because the House was in session, by unanimous consent to basically stop all business, to basically shelve the calendar, and to prepare to authorize war powers to give to the president. It was done in 15 minutes. So don't think that they have these rules that are there that would stop emergency situations. They do have a contingency to break glass in case of an emergency. But again, it takes unanimous consent. Now, whereas the Senate is over here, the House chamber is on the other side of the building. That wing of the state, or the Capitol building, is where all House operations take place. And yes, this is the room that you saw if you watched the video on the joint session. This is where the president goes in and gives the State of the Union. Why? Because it's bigger. That's all. It was designed to have more seating capacity. As I said, everything is controlled by rules. The rules in the House are technically known as standing rules. And one of the most important rules, in my opinion, I don't remember the exact rule number, but since the 1990s, one of the ranking rules is that all House sessions must be broadcast. So you have the ability any day of the week to put on C-SPAN 1, and you can watch what's going on in the House. And they will either bounce to committee hearings or they will go to the floor. So we the people have the ability to peer inside and see what our representatives are doing. Every single day, the presiding officer, sometimes the Speaker of the House, but the Speaker of the House also has the authority to appoint a temporary or an acting presiding officer. They start the day off at approximately 10 a.m. They get up to the DS and they crack the gavel. And the session stays, or the chamber stays in session, until there is a majority vote to end the session. And like the Senate, they do have a calendar. And it's the calendar that controls the scheduling of all of the different hearings and procedures. But unlike the Senate, which has two calendars, the House has three. You have the official House calendar that shows all of the bills and resolutions awaiting action. But you also have a majority
and a minority party calendar.
While those are public, the purpose of the majority and the minority calendars are to make the membership aware of what's going on.
And, like in the Senate, the same three actions are taking place. They're either holding committee hearings, they are engaged in floor debate, or they're voting on measures. Questions? Give you a couple of elements of what makes the House unique. The first, as I mentioned, the members are chosen by districts. Now, Article 1, Section 2, Clause 5 requires that every state has at least one representative. That's the minimum. And Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 requires the census every 10 years.
So, if you have a more populous state and you have more representatives, this is where apportionment comes in. Because every 10 years, they redraft the districts.
Now, FYI, since 1929, we have had 435 members of the House. Those 435 seats, though, are separated. Seats 1 to 50, and all the seats are numbered. Not that the number has any issue of standing. But seats 1 to 50 are divided out equally amongst all the states. Every state gets at least one rep. And then 51 to 435 are based on population. So what does that mean? You have big states that have many representatives, and you have smaller states that may only have one. All right. I do have the last census data. This was 2020. California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia all lost one seat. Colorado, Florida, Montana, North Carolina, Oregon gained one, and Texas gained two.
A lot of red states gained one, huh?
Well, think about what happened during COVID. A lot of people that could go remote basically saying, why the hell am I going to live in like Massachusetts that is completely locked down? I went to Florida a whole bunch of times during COVID. There was no mask down there.
Really?
Yeah. There was no, like, you could have to wear the mask into a restaurant until your bum hits the floor, but the moment your bum hits the seat, then magically you're not going to get COVID.
Right.
There was none of the, oh, you got to have 6 feet social distancing, because COVID doesn't spread 6'1". It's only 6 feet. You know, none of the ridiculous rules that we had up here were down in Florida.
So nobody was locked in all the time and stuff?
No.
They
locked it down initially, but Florida was the first state to open it up. So a lot of people like, why the hell do I want to live out of Massachusetts? It's all this crap. Sure. They got their cars and move south. Plus, Florida has no income tax. Texas has no income tax. A lot of people from California moving to Texas.
Does Connecticut have income tax?
Yep. Yeah. I think it's the same. No, I think it's higher than ours.
Really?
Yeah, ours is 5%. I think theirs is 6. Could be wrong, though. Anyone from Connecticut? All right, gerrymandering. We talked about gerrymandering already. This is where they redistrict the legislatures. By the way, and my numbers may not be precise for every state, but over the last 30 years, the average population per district, the average is about 725,000 people per district. Now, obviously, there are some states that don't have that many people in their districts or a little smaller. But if you looked at the big districts in California to the small districts, the average is about 725,000.
Oh, and gerrymandering. So it's the states that make the districts. I'll put that in there because we did talk about that.
And how often do they do that?
Every census. So every 10 years.
Okay. Now, FYI, back in the 2000 census, I think it was the 2000 census,
the Speaker of the Massachusetts State House, Tom Finneran, got himself into federal problems. He was subject to a federal investigation because of what he was doing during his leadership over the gerrymandering process. So there are times when the parties do go a little to the extreme, but Finneran never went to jail. He just had to pay a fine. But
okay.
All right. Quorums. There must be a majority present.
So you take 435, divide it in half, and add 1. In order to vote, there must be 218 members present.
Now, the quorum is typically assumed, but members do have the ability to make a quorum call, where whoever is the presiding officer basically has to count how many members are actually present in the hall.
Now, if a quorum call is called and there is no quorum, you don't vote. You suspend the session, you come back the next day.
So, again, if you get to watch C-SPAN frequently, what sometimes happens is say the members are on a committee meeting, and then someone in the main chamber calls for quorum, the committee chairman will get word from his page, they will then suspend the committee session, and the members will report to the House chamber
in order to vote present for the quorum.
Or sometimes the majority and the minority leader make a deal where they maintain the ratio of their party members, and so just enough of the Democrats and just enough of the Republicans show up to hit that quorum, but in proportion to their party's makeup in the House.
I don't want to say shenanigans, but it's just, you know, the way they play politics.
Lastly, last individual item, and then we'll call it a day, is what is referred to as the Committee of a Whole. Now, under the House rules, with the exception of voting on bills, the chamber may operate more informally if the House moves to meet as a Committee of the Whole. They do this to quicken the process. So, let's say there are 5 bills that have to be debated. Instead of giving all 435 members the right to vote, the parties will vote to authorize the use of the Committee of the Whole, which is comprised of 100 members. Now, they can't use this to vote, but they can use this to debate. So basically, again, it's all in proportion to the makeup of their party. And currently the Republicans only have, 4 or 5 extra seats than the Democrats. So it might be 52-48.
That's so interesting how government officials fluctuate like that. Shenanigans they play. You know, I don't agree with all that. I still think it's right.
All right. Well, governing is complicated. And if you were to have 435 members suddenly sit back and be like, well, I don't want to do this for different reasons, would you ever get anything done?
Never.
So a lot of the procedural rules have developed over our 250
years of history, going back to the colonial period, just to make sure that government processes get completed.
All right, so Committee of the Whole, they vote, 100 members can debate, but in order to vote, you need the full chamber. Okay? All right. I will be posting your midterms in about an hour or two. I'm awful. I was just busy over break. Plus, two people in the class did not take it. But if I don't hear from them today and they don't take a test, I'm going to count it as a zero for the midterm grade because I can't keep the whole class waiting on this time.
Is that exam we just took, that's what
you're saying? No. The midterm is going to be the average of exam one and two.
Oh, okay.